From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The ongoing transformation of the Trump for President campaign to the President-elect's transition team has continued with some developments over this past weekend. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia via Skype Monday morning.
In terms of Trump's appointments thus far, from what I can see, it's not an impressive group. It is, however, a group of outsiders that primarily come from the center right. Beyond that, I can't say a lot. But we can see already significant effects of the Trump election. For example, in Lima, Peru this past weekend, APEC, the Asian Pacific Economic Council, met. And the star of the show was Xi Jinping, the president of China. And the Chinese have announced, in the wake of what is the imminent collapse of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that they will now propose a regional economic free trade zone, which will include already seven of the original signers of the TPP, seven of them, plus others, ASEAN and others. So it already looks to have a robust kind of membership. More than that, it will exclude the United States initially. But here's the significance. It will not be based upon, as the TPP was, the complete hegemony of Western corporations, especially American corporations, over the laws, the economic policies, even the politics of the member nations. And I find this to be quite significant. If you put this together with the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, the president, moving away from the United States, calling for the U.S. military to be out of his country in 2 years. And then highly significant is that one of the initial signers to this new Chinese-led regional pact is Vietnam.
And Turkey.
This is quite, pardon me?
And Turkey's also expressed interest in it, which just broke.
Yes. And I was going to get to Turkey because that's the other shoe that's about to fall, I think. Turkey seems not to even want to pursue membership in the European Union now, after years and years of having been told that your political system, your culture, and so on don't fit Western values, which, you know, everybody interpreted as a institutional form of Islamophobia. It looks like Turkey is going to move towards the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is, at least Erdogan, the president, has made statements to that effect or suggested that. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization consists of five members, China and Russia, the major ones, but then it has a whole number of associate members, including countries like Iran and others that I can't remember off the top of my head. But for Turkey to move from NATO, which is a military and geostrategic organization, to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is but the first step in moving away from the Western Economic Military Alliance to one that is Asian and Eastern. And so, let me, I'll just end on this. So the other shoe, Philippines first, now Turkey, the collapse of TPP. We're in a whole new international situation. And a lot of this has to do with the election and the breaking of the hold upon foreign and global economic policy, the breaking of their domination of the neoliberal managerial classes, control of that. This is huge.
China's economic relationship with the United States is significantly different from any other relationship that it has in terms of policy. You know, forgetting the fact that, of course, in terms of scale, the United States reaches agreements with China on trade, you know, decades now. And those agreements allow investment of Western capital into China to develop a productive capacity that is now the world's largest, and to reap all kinds of profits based on the labor costs, which, by the way, are not because the workers in China are impoverished, but rather through exchange rate devices. You know, people have to understand Chinese workers may not make the same wages that American workers make or union workers make in the United States. They have free health care, they have free education, their housing is heavily subsidized, all of that stuff. So, you know, those are, and that comes from the profits from the Chinese government in these joint ventures. But the rest of it, the money that is run through the global corporations just ends up in the bank of the people that own them, basically. And that's the, you know, $4 trillion, for example, or better, that Trump is talking about repatriating. And there's, we get impoverished. China's relationship with almost every other country is on the basis of what the policy they call win-win, which looks to actually develop the economies of the partners so that the workers there are more prosperous and can buy more goods from China. Do you think Trump sees a possibility of reorienting U.S. Economic relationship with China on that basis? And do you think China sees that there's some real opportunities in, say, building factories or investing in the construction of factories and things here, and maybe a realignment of currencies that would make the wages more on par?
I think Trump was absolutely right in suggesting that these old rules have to be renegotiated. We could perhaps go even further and say that we need a fundamental break with those rules because they privilege finance capital. Now, most of the countries that China trades with are in one or another way either socialist or state capitalist. So you have a synergy between the modes of organization, let us say, of the Chinese economy and, for example, the economy of Russia, the economy of the Philippines, and other developing countries. In other words, they look more alike than any of them look like the U.S. or British or German economies. Right. The other thing is that these are not just state capitalists, which means that the state regulates, heavily regulates the economy, or socialist or early socialist economies, early developmental stages of socialist economies. But the other thing is that these are economies not based upon the hegemony of bank and finance capital, but of production. Right. Now, how does this fit into at least what Trump has talked about in terms of trillions of dollars of infrastructure development? Well, the United States does not have the productive capacity to produce everything necessary to begin this infrastructure development. So that means we'll have to do business with other countries that still have productive capacities. That means, for example, China, machine production, tool production. It means, for example, a new relationship with countries that produce natural resources or countries that manufacture or produce cement and other things. Now, in terms of Chinese investment in the U.S. economy, I think that is a win-win. For example, how do we get U.S. steel and auto production restarted in this country? So from a global strategic economic standpoint, a reconfiguring of the U.S. economy away from finance towards production would make our economy look more like most economies in the world. It would thus pull the rug out from under the predatory finance capitalists. I think we are in new territory. Now, whether Trump can govern is a whole nother question. But his statements during the campaign move in that direction. I think that we need an intelligent and sophisticated left that begins to talk about what these ideas stated in the most general sense mean concretely.
Looking at the current situation through the lens of power politics, of constituencies, in terms of, relative forces. Trump right now, if he makes it, he's got quite a hurdle from now to January 20th. You got to get through this thing with the Electoral College. Then you got to get through January. If you get through that, then you go to January 6th, joint session of Congress, when they recertify. If you don't get through that, then it goes to the House of Representatives, and that's Paul Ryan and whoever, if it's Pelosi or whoever that ends up being, that'll broker that. If they do get to January 6th, then they have to get through a joint session of Congress, which includes the Senate. And, you've got McConnell and Reid there, okay, and whatever deal they broker. And then if he gets through that, he's got to live 2 weeks to January 20th without a plane crash or a heart attack or, an accidental stray bullet through the forehead, whatever. And then, looking at what'll be a hostile Congress on these issues, on foreign policy for sure. So, because, the Congress is essentially a creature of finance capital at the moment, like most government and other institutions. If he gets there, now he's on his own. And even now, going through this stuff, he's on his own. He was elected by not even a plurality. He had a minority, a vote across the board, bare minority. And part of that, is not going to be useful to him going forward. If he chooses to do like Hitler did, and let's talk about the real Hitler, and make a deal with Wall Street and governs as a hard right president, we will have fascism. But it seems that he doesn't want that, and perhaps they don't want that either. So now he has to figure out how to govern while they're trying to make it impossible for him. And the only thing I see him able to do is to do whatever it takes in terms of expressing policy to build a mass constituency, which means a lot of bridge building that he's going to have to do, and he's going to have to do some hard work to do that, including, here's $500 billion to develop inner cities or whatever. Shouldn't we be trying to encourage that direction? Aren't there things we could do to encourage it?
Well, I think so. But you see, I'm of the opinion that we, some years ago, maybe 20 years ago, crossed the Rubicon and became a corporatist state, which if you really want to understand what, and I put quotes, what fascism looks like, what it is the state or the political party that runs the state turning over much of the day-to-day operations of society to executives and corporate managers.
Right.
And we crossed that Rubicon to privatization some time ago, as you well know.
Just in terms of legitimacy, that's essentially the definition that Mussolini gave to it, a rather authoritative figure in the development of fascist ideology.
Absolutely. And that is the deal that Hitler made with the corporation.
That's right.
He ran on one platform, demagogically, But then he made a deal once he got to power, or a deal that got him into power,
right,
that he would let the corporations and the banks do their thing.
Right.
And then, of course, he made another deal with the military and the security system.
That's right.
So he governed on behalf of the banks and the military. And in return, he allowed them to basically manage society.
Right.
We have been there for at least a couple of decades.
Right.
Which means, and this is part of the instinctive rage of so many ordinary people, that government doesn't govern. And citizenship means little, if nothing. Everything is privatized. Everything is corporatized. So I think we crossed that Rubicon some time ago. Now, what Trump promised is to bring that system down. Now, you have to read between the lines, and you can't rely upon the corporate media and sound bites to extract that message from his speeches for you. That is the dangerous message of Donald Trump, especially to the super managers and the corporatists who are very comfortable with this mode of running government. And of course, TPP, if it had gone forward, and if it goes forward, would further diminish citizenship sovereignty and further enhance the power of transnational corporations, not only over the economies and politics and lives of smaller nations, but of our nation itself.
Right.
So all of that is a part of the subtext of the Trump movement. Now, of course, the Trump movement is not just one thing. It's not a class movement, although it has, as I think, the most dynamic factor in it, the working class and those nearest to the working class. Yeah,
even Schumer's admitting that now.
Yes. I mean, it's an undeniable truth. However, while admitting that, the Bernie Sanders and the Schumers and the other people who run the Democratic Party, when looking back, why did we lose? Well, we weren't in touch with the working class. While admitting that, they, on the other hand, are the central force behind much of the fear-mongering and organization of the protests against Trump in the interest of going back to the system, or at least putting back in power the corporatists and super managers who have been running things for the last, 25 years.
The record on that is very clear. Just the legislative record, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, NAFTA,
right,
the entire changes to the international architecture since Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, but really intensifying in from 93 to 2000 with Clinton.
Absolutely. It took a quote unquote liberal Democrat to do the corporatist work, the dirty work of the corporation.
Only Nixon
repeal
could go to
China. Glass-Steagall. Only Nixon could go to China. So, when we look at this in a fundamental way, what we see is that it is not Trump that has brought us fascism. And I put quotes on that word, or corporatism, which is the essence of the governing form of fascism or Nazism. It was not Trump that brought us that. It was a combination of liberal and conservative Republicans and Democrats. In other words, it was a regime decision.
The bipartisan consensus.
the bipartisan consensus, yes. So now, what does that mean going forward, or what does it mean at this time? You know, there was an article in Politico which openly stated that the Obama operatives and functionaries from the White House to the Democratic Party and local areas are very much involved and committed to bringing down the Trump presidency, and are, in fact, at this time on the ground playing a very large role in the organization of the of these demonstrations. The other side of it is that the so-called liberal or mainstream or corporate media is continuing what they were doing throughout this campaign, and that is the Stop Trump movement. They are providing the ideological and informational framework promoting most of these demonstrations, although they appear on the ground to have a left liberal a thrust, that we're afraid of Islamophobia, we're afraid of racism, we're afraid of the misogyny that Trump represents, and on and on and on. But this is a politic of upending the Trump presidency, and I would say primarily in the interest of reconsolidating the power of the neoliberal managerial forces class that have been running things for at least 25 years.
You know, we've been talking, you brought this to the discussion, and we've been talking about it ever since. You know, we're in a condition of crisis. The fundamentals that caused the crisis, or that any event have caused the crisis of legitimacy, and the expression of that in the political, you know, around, you know, in the streets and the political system, you know, it's only going to intensify because the fundamentals are not being addressed, unless they are addressed. And that's what some people hope Trump is going to do. You know, the people that are looking to provoke the political crisis here, I'm wondering what they're seeing as they look through it. Because if you're looking at creating a revolutionary condition, you know, when you come to revolutionary condition, if you are prepared to lead, and that doesn't mean in your own brain you think you're smart enough to lead, but you have the structures in place to lead, you have the mass organization to lead, you have the class unity and the will and a program that it's organized around to lead that you can implement. If you don't do that, well, all the other forces are allied against you, and at the end of the day, they win. How do you take and sequence things to accomplish being ready for the class to step into power when the opportunity and when the void is created, or in any event, when the door can be kicked open?
A lot is riding on our understanding of American history and the dynamics of American history and how race and class are determinative factors in all politics and so on. So we have to have the sense of our own history, of the development and current status of our own working class and the masses in general. We have to understand from on the ground what working people and the poor are saying. We cannot allow their voices to be filtered through the petty bourgeoisie immature leftists who, frankly, and this is what we're seeing, Don. I mean, you're raising the question of power, but to get to that point, we have to work through just what, in fact, is the left.
Right.
You know, the left is not the same as the liberals, but then the left is not the same as those immature, infantile groups who are basically tails or following the liberals. Right. I mean, we have to work through all of this.
It's also not the alt-right, whatever that the hell that is. And it's not really well-defined out in the mass media, by the way, except as being some sort of nebulous merge of the Klan and the Nazi Party or something. But it's, in fact, quite different from that. But, you know, that's a void that the left left for to be filled. And well, we see that across Europe, too.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. In fact, you know, we see almost implicit in a lot of the demonstrations an attack, an open attack upon the working class, the white working class for voting for Trump, the black working class for not showing up. That's almost implicit. Some of it is very explicit under identity politics. Yep. So we have a lot of ideological work. Now, I would not confine that work to convincing anarchists and Trotskyists and far leftists of this position. I think we have to go among the masses and begin the long and difficult process of the organization and political education of ordinary people. And this is going to occur, as you mentioned, in the throes of perhaps the greatest political crisis this country has seen since the Civil War. And it is a political crisis, and the nation is divided down the center. And the nation is divided along class lines. And by this, I mean not just the 1% versus the 99%, but I mean elements of the urban cosmopolitan petty bourgeoisie against the working class, or in opposition to the working class. Another way to put that is the politics of identity versus the politics of social economic transformation. So we have a great deal of work. Now, of course, that broad swath of young people who come to this without a great deal of experience are going to make mistakes. There's no question about that. Anarchism and Trotskyism and other far left ideas appeal to them out the gate. And that's for all of us. We were all a part of that at one time. But we have to be steadfast, I think. That working people are going to look at how the Trump presidency and what he says will affect their day-to-day lives. They will not become a part of these demonstrations. They're not going to do it. I think the working class is going to hold fast and see. And I could say in particular, I know that to be the case from Black Philadelphia. And, you know, I live here. I know the city. I know the people here. And I really know the Black community here. And they have a sense of we are not doing better after 8 years of Obama. One of the reasons we didn't vote, because not only did we not like Hillary or Trump, but we do no longer see any way to improve our conditions through electing people, so we withheld our votes. And they're going to wait and see. They might not like Trump. They might not like the people around him. And there's every reason not to if you're Black. But if he can deliver, and here my last point, he cannot govern going through the normal channels of the Congress and the Senate and the political parties. He will have to go over their heads to the people. He has the skill to do that. If he does that, then he wins the people and probably wins a second term.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.